Already we can make a start. Okay, change of topic today. I'm going to talk about the development of reasoning, thinking of reasoning, from the preschool period to school age. And we're going to look at the development of what Piaget calls operational thinking, concrete operational thinking. So the transition from the pre-operational stage to the concrete operational stage. Piaget is arguing children become able to think and reason about concrete things, things they can see and touch and handle and can get direct information about. And we're going to look at the development of their logical understanding, where they go beyond the information given and they begin to appreciate the underlying logical principles. And I picked out four areas. There are quite a number we could look at. We don't have time. More of them are reviewed in the textbook, in the Bjorklund text. So I'm going to focus on these four areas. Two kinds of reasoning, transitive reasoning and deductive reasoning. And then what Piaget refers to as an understanding of class inclusion. That is, the organization of hierarchical classification. And I'll explain all this in a moment. Just go with it for now. And then finally is discovery of conservation, understanding that physical properties can remain unchanged, set properties can remain unchanged, even though appearance may alter drastically. So let me just explain what each of these areas is about, and then we'll look at some research that challenges Piaget's interpretation. So this is transitive reasoning. It's a particular kind of deductive reasoning, typically involving physical quantities, where you can order the items into a series. So here we're talking about height. Okay? What could be size? What's height? So if I give you this information, two pieces of information, that Alan is taller than Betty, and Betty is taller than Colin, and then I ask you the question, who is taller, Alan or Colin? You can make an inference. You can go beyond the information I've given to come up with a new fact which is logically correct. That it's got to be Alan. Okay? And do that by linking the two items of this middle term here, Betty, and you can derive a relationship between Alan and Colin because you can reason transitively. You understand the logical processes involved in making a correct deduction there. Now, Piaget examined this kind of reasoning by asking young children these sorts of questions, and he found that they were pretty poor until about the age of 6 or 7, when they started to give correct answers. Either the kids would guess, they didn't know what the answer was, or they refused to answer. This is interesting. A lot of these children refused to give an answer because they said they didn't know these people. They couldn't see them. And, of course, that supported his interpretation that these children were figurative thinkers who needed to actually see individuals to figure out who was going to be taller. But either way, they didn't show any evidence of being able to make this transitive inference. So that's the problem we're going to be looking at there. With regard to deductive reasoning, he actually asked lots of children questions. Here's a nice little example of some of the problems he finds. That his claim is that the preschool children appear to engage in reasoning, sometimes come up with the right answer, but very often make mistakes. They are not systematic in their reasoning, and their reasoning is what he called pre-logical. It's not based on an understanding of the underlying logic. So here's a case. This is a little boy. How old was he? 4 and a half? 4 and a half. Yeah. And he's got two sisters, so there are 3 children in the family. And he gets asked these questions. How many sisters do you have? And he gives the correct answer, 2. Do your sisters have a brother? Yes, he says. All this is correct. He's giving correct answers. Do you have a brother? And quick as a flash, he said, yes. And he seems to be basing his reasoning on this assumption. He has 2 sisters, my sisters have a brother, therefore I have a brother. So there's some kind of logic there. He's making a connection at this midterm by the virtue of his sisters, but he derives the conclusion that he must therefore have a brother. He doesn't have a brother, he's the only boy in the family. But he's come up with an inconsistent conclusion which isn't based on systematic understanding of how to reason logically. In fact, Piaget argues that a genuine understanding of how to draw inferences correctly is difficult to demonstrate, because you want to eliminate the influence of the child's knowledge. You want to get evidence that children understand the logical principles of drawing an inference and are only using logic to do this. And he offered this litmus test for the ability to reason deductively. This is what he said, I'll explain what he means in a moment. He said, conclusions drawn from premises must be held to be true only by reason of the premises and quite independently of the empirical truth of these premises. Now what he's getting at here is that children, if they really have the ability to reason logically, to make correct inferences, make deductions, should be able to reason with information that actually is factually incorrect. It may be logically consistent, but it's factually incorrect. And if it's factually incorrect, they obviously cannot rely on what they know. They must rely only on reason to come up the answer. Let me flesh that out with a concrete example which will make it absolutely clear what Piaget is getting at. Okay, so here's a nice syllogism. I can give you two pieces of information and then ask a question to see if the child can make an impact. So here's a piece of information. All cats meow, Rex is a cat. Does Rex meow? So we can combine these two statements, okay, by this term here, all cats meow, Rex is a cat. By definition, obviously, logically, Rex must be able to meow. So the logical answer is yes, but the problem with asking kids these sorts of questions is their knowledge. The factual answer is also yes. In fact, you don't need to give all this information. All you need to tell the child is Rex is a cat, does Rex meow? And they have that information readily to hand. So you can't determine whether children are deriving the correct answer by virtue of reasoning, by logic, or whether they're simply retrieving information from memory. Same is true even if the correct answer is no. All fishes live in water, tops of the fish, does top live in a tree? Obviously, no. The logical answer is no, given that information you can give. But the factual answer is no as well. So we really can't tell from that observation whether children are reasoning or not. What Piaget is offering with his litmus test of the ability to reason deductively is evidence that children can still reason logically, can come up with the correct logical inference, even though the information is factually incorrect and it doesn't match up with what they know in memory. So, let's try some counterfactual syllogisms, okay? All cats bark. Rex is a cat. Does Rex bark? Now, if you can reason logically, even though the information you've been given is nonsense, it clearly contradicts what you know. If you can derive the correct logical answer, then clearly you have the ability to reason. You've got the understanding of the logical process. Okay? And you can see the two answers are different. The logical answer is yes, the factual answer will be no. So a child who says yes is most likely reasoning. A child who says no appears to be unable to reason. And the same is true if we have a no answer as the correct logical answer. Now Piaget tested a whole load of children on these kinds of problems, and what he found was that the ability to give these kinds of answers, correct logical answers, developed late, so around age 10 and 11. And in fact, that age has been confirmed by more recent research. It's absolutely right. If you go in and you ask children these sorts of questions, then it's really late when you get the correct logical answers. So Piaget's arguing that in the concrete operational period, you appear to get reasoning, but it's supported very much by what the child knows. They give correct answers, they can combine the information correctly, they don't make the sort of errors that you get in the pre-logical period. They give the correct answer, but when the information contradicts what they know, what they have in memory, Then you get incorrect answers until about age 10 or 11. And in fact, he argued this is a late accomplishment that heralds the onset of this final stage of development. When children can begin to process abstract information. So we'll look at some research that explores that search in a moment. In the case of class inclusion, he's here interested in children's knowledge of hierarchical structures, organizations, and particularly the relationships between different levels in a hierarchy. Here's a very simple hierarchy. Okay? We've got a collection of six beads, of which four of them are black and two of them are white. Okay? Now, given these numbers, and given how this original, complete set is made up, we know that the number of items in each of the subsets must necessarily be less than the number in the complete set. That is a logical property of the way hierarchies are organized. Okay? So the number of items in the subsets must, by definition, be less than the number of items in the overall collection, the overall set. Now, where and how do children come by this information? Do they know it? Well, Piaget carried out this sort of task and asked them this kind of question. In fact, he had a larger number of beads, but we've got some black beads, we've got some white ones, and he asked kids this question. Are there more black beads or more beads? So are there more black beads or are there more beads? What he's getting at here is, are there more in the subset or are there more in the overall collection, the overall set? And of course the answer should be there are more beads. Notice a lot of puzzled faces. It's a funny question, isn't it? Yeah? Something wrong with it. It's an odd kind of question. We don't normally get asked it. Maybe you don't get asked it because we just know this. We have this knowledge. Yeah? So people don't go around asking this. But I think there's a little more to it than that. It is an odd question. It sort of pulls you up at a halt because you weren't expecting it. And what Piaget found was children younger than six will answer incorrectly. They'll say, oh, there are more black beads. So they go for the subset claim there are more there than the overall set. Okay? But, you know, we've seen with Piaget before, often he's asking children quite difficult questions, and I think this is a difficult question. Other researchers agree it is a difficult question. So we'll look at some research that modifies the question a little bit and actually reveals what really is going on in this situation. So up until about six, children are answering correctly. After six and eight, they become concrete operational thinkers and they begin to demonstrate a knowledge of the logical relationships involved in hierarchies. And then the final topic is conservation. Remember I gave you this example, two examples. Here, conservation is a number where you lay out two arrays of counters or smarties or something like that. Charles agrees that it's the same number in both. And then one of them is transformed in some way, either by pushing them closer together or making the row wider and longer. And then the child is asked, are there more here, or are they the same? And younger children, until about age six, give an incorrect answer. They'll typically answer that this row now must be more, and this one has less. And similarly with understanding changes in liquid amount. We have two containers with the same amount of juice. You pour one into a different shaped container. It can be, this one is tall and skinny, you can be a short fat one. The appearance looks different. And up until about the age of seven, children would give an incorrect answer. They believe that not only appearance, but the amount has changed along with this transformation. And after about seven, they begin to give correct answers. So they've got this principle of invariance, conservation, as Piaget calls it. They know that something remains constant, in this case now, despite perceptual change. Okay, so those are our four areas. So I'm going to review one or two pieces of research for each of them, which challenges Piaget's conclusions that young preschool children don't have any understanding of this kind of reasoning, and there is some change taking place at around age 6 or 7 when they enter a new stage of development. Now, the time is limited, I can only cover 70 examples. You can read about more research in the relevant chapters in the Yorkton text and the other references I've given. Let's turn to another piece of research by Peter Bryant and Tom Trabasco, which is a landmark study because they demonstrated one of the flaws in Piaget's work and also how to demonstrate transitive reasoning in children as young as 4. Right, this is the sort of thing that they were doing. They were telling children about the coloured sticks. Okay, initially, kids don't see these sticks, so if you say the red stick is taller or longer than the white one, okay, first piece of information. Then the second piece of information is the white stick is longer than the yellow one. So red is longer than white, white is longer than yellow. Which is longer, red or yellow? Typically the kind of question that Piaget is asking young children. Now, Bryant and Trabasco found that occasionally kids would give a correct answer, okay? But they make a very important point. And the point is that this kind of test where you've got three items, a red, a white, a yellow, is insufficient to demonstrate that kids really are reasoning logically. And why is that? It's because there is a simpler, non-reasoning strategy that the children could use. So when you tell them that red, they don't see these sticks, of course. If they saw them, they'd have perceptual information. So they've just got to be given the information verbally. So when you tell them red is longer than short, maybe what the kids are doing is thinking, oh yeah, red is long, white is short. Okay? So they're simply labeling these two sticks. Red is long, white is short. Now you tell them that white is longer than yellow, and now they think white is long and yellow is short. Okay? And then when you ask them which is longer, red or yellow, they retrieve this information from memory. Red, long, yellow, short. Oh, red is longer. They're not thinking about the white stick and using that as an intermediary to link the two pieces of information. They're simply retrieving information, facts that they've learned that are in memory to answer the question. So it's not reasoning, it's not transitive reasoning in a systematic way. It's just retrieving information from memory. And this is always a problem if you only have three items in the comparison. It will always be a problem. White, you can see here, is getting a bit ambiguous. In this relationship, it's short. In this one, it's long. So, you know, it's both long and short. But the red one, the yellow one, are quite unambiguous. And that may be how children can give a correct answer. So what Bryant and Trabasco said is the minimum number of items you need to properly test for ability to reason transitively is 5. You must have 5 items, so any test that has only 3 isn't going to work, because there could always be an alternative explanation. And this is how they did the experiment. In fact, they did have sticks present, they had coloured sticks available. So there's a little reminder to the children, but the kids never get to see how long they are, because they're embedded, they're set in this block of wood, and the holes here get longer and longer as you move across. So red is the longest, the green one at the end is the shortest, but the children, when they see sticks that are only the same length. So the kids first show this pair, A and B, the others are removed, and they're told the red stick is longer than the white one. Okay? And then they're asked to recall that information, and then whoever takes away and the next two are shown beside each other, the white and the yellow, and they're told the white one is longer than the yellow. And then the red one will be put back. They never see the complete length of it. And then they're asked, which is longer, red or white? Which is longer, white or yellow? There's obviously an extensive period of training, and it can take quite some time with 4-year-olds, but you work your way through all of the 6 here, okay? And you make sure the child remembers all that information. That the red is longer than the white, white longer than yellow is longer than blue, blue is longer than green. Okay, now if you think about that labeling strategy, the kids might be thinking red, long, white, short. And then when I talk about white and yellow, white long, yellow short. So white is going to be ambiguous. It's going to be long in one pairing and short in another. And if that's what you're remembering, you're not really going to know whether it's longer than shorter than another stick. Similarly, the blue one here, B, is both long and short. It's longer than the green and shorter than the yellow. So Brian Trabasso argues that we now ignore the two end sticks, A and E. We leave those out because if the kids are using this labeling strategy, they'll have unique labels for each of them. That's long and that's short. These in the middle here will be both long and short, and the kids can't rely on that information to come up with the correct answer. So we need five items, but it's this comparison here between B and D that's critical. That's the one we need to ask the kids about to demonstrate an ability to reason transitively. And that's what they ask them. Which is longer, the white or the blue? So this simple naming strategy isn't going to work. And what they found was that even after this extensive training, this extra information, children as young as four could give significantly more correct answers than you'd expect by chance to this BD question. Okay? So chance would be 50%. Which is longer? Well, it could be one, it could be the other. They've got a 50-50 chance of being right. And you can see they're doing much, much better than chance. As they get older, they improve. It's not surprising. They've got better memory, better attention. But there's absolutely no doubt that these four-year-olds have this ability to reason transitively. Now, what's interesting is that when you look at the errors they make, and you ask them the questions about the pairings of things, which they need to remember in order to come up with the correct answers. So we've got B, D, and E, okay? So there we are. B, C, and D. The question asks about B and D. So if you ask them which is longer, B or C, which is longer, C or D, it turns out that when they get the critical BD question wrong, most likely they have forgotten one of the key pairings that they need to remember in order to give a correct answer. So it's their memory that's letting them down when they make errors, not their ability to reason. They have an ability to reason, and when the youngest kids make errors, it's because they've forgotten a critical piece of information. So that's a very different account from the one that Piaget is giving us. And it's clear that this ability is emerging much earlier than Piaget thought was possible. Errors occur, and it's down to memory, forgetting things, rather than an inability to reason. Now, what about counterfactual reasoning? What about this litmus test that Piaget has given? He's absolutely right about that. If you can demonstrate children can reason with this counterfactual information and they give correct answers, then it's obvious they cannot be relying on information in memory. It must be reasoning logically. There's no doubt about that. We're 100% with Piaget on that. Where they're going to differ is in the age and the stage at which this ability emerges. This was first examined in a study by Pierce Harris. And what they did was to present young children, four, 5 or 6 year olds, with what they called these counterfactual syllogisms, contrary fact syllogisms. So here's the one I've given you previously. All cats bark, except the cat does rex bark. And as you know, the logical answer is yes, the factual answer is no. In addition, they asked the children to explain their answers, to give justification. Now, with four-year-olds, that's a little bit tricky, but you can ask them, well, why did you say yes, or why did you say no? And they categorize their justifications in different ways. Now, these are two key categories they use. One, they talked about empirical justifications, where the child explains her answer with reference to her own experience. Okay, so, for example, all cats bark, Rex is a cat, and Rex bark. And the child says no. And you ask, why did you say no? And the child says, because I've got a cat at home, and my cat goes meow, doesn't bark. That's an appeal to experience. Or, my mum told me cats go meow, they don't bark. Mums get blamed for many things. So, you know, there's a source of information. Okay? On the other hand, they also look for what they call theoretical justifications. This is from where they make reference to the information here in the syllogism. Okay? So here, a child might say, in answer to the question, is Rex Bart? Child might say, yes. Gets the correct answer. Why did you say that? Okay? Well, a child who is reasoning correctly and can give a theoretical justification might say something like, because you told me all cats can bark and Rex is a cat. Okay? So they're appealing to the information in the syllogism. They're clearly showing evidence that they're thinking about that information. They're not relying on their experience. They might do. You could get a child that gives the correct answer, yes, and says, because I've heard cats bark. I live in Lockheed and cats all bark in Lockheed. It could be something like that. See the difference? And they're looking for evidence that not only kids give the right answers, but can back them up. There's some understanding about where that information has come from. Right, now, if you test children in the way that Piaget tested them, you walk in, you sit down, you read out these good stories, okay, in a matter-of-fact way, then you'll get exactly the answers that Piaget got. You'll find that young children will not show evidence of being able to reason logically. Right? And one of the problems that Jason Harris thought about was that, you know, maybe the child is having difficulty understanding exactly what you want him to do. That he's to accept this information, this wacky, weird information that you're giving about these barking cats and fish that live in trees and all these other things, okay? And maybe what they're doing is they're just ignoring that, they're rejecting it and falling back on what they know and using that as the basis. So maybe it's possible they could reason, right? But something they're choosing not to, they're ignoring this information because it's wrong and it's weird and they know something else. So what if you help the kids a little bit? You don't give them the answer, but you put them in a situation where cats do bark and fish do live in trees. In other words, we have a pretend world. And that's what they do, this particular experiment. That's the way you set this up. But they tested the children in two different groups. They tested one group, they called them the verbal group, exactly as Piaget did. You read out the stories, matter-of-fact way, and you see what the answer's like. Second group, before they're tested, they say, now sit down, let's pretend we're on another planet. Okay? Kids kind of look around, and they go, oh, interesting. Maria Diaz, who was a PhD student before Harris, said she was from Brazil, so it wasn't difficult. She said they all believed she was from another planet because she had an accent, you know, looked a little bit different. So they're thinking, oh, we're on another planet. And then you say, I'm going to tell you some stories about what happens in this place. Kids will get interested now. Okay? And then in quite a dramatic voice, she says, okay, in this place, all cats can bark. Rex is a cat. Can Rex bark? So we've got two settings. Yeah? Straightforward, normal, everyday, verbal setting, and then the pretense. And the idea is that if we put the kids into this pretense context, then maybe we can free them up from the influence of what they know, and we can really tap into their reasoning ability. And it turns out that that's what happens. Four-year-olds, in the data for number of correct responses, when you test children in the verbal condition, you get very few correct answers. You get a very low level of success. However, change the context, put them into a pretense context, and you get more than more than doubles. There's a massive increase. They're not perfect. And these are demanding questions. They're not perfect. But clearly, the difference between this low level and this level here indicates that they are reasoning logically. But quite often, they can set aside what they know and come up with the correct answer. Older children, six-year-olds, you can see it doing better. This isn't surprising. They're developing. Also, the attention is better. The memory is better. But we get exactly the same effect here. ourselves to Cora in the standard verbal condition, doing much better in the pretense condition. And if you look at the justifications, then the justifications for their answers support that interpretation. For the four-year-olds, even when they give a correct answer, none of them could explain the reason why they give that answer. But some of them are significantly more are able to do so when they're in the pretend setting and get exactly the same effect. But they increase the number of theoretical justifications at 6 years. So that effect has been replicated at times. It turns out you can actually get children to reason logically in these conditions, four-year-olds, if you simply tell them to imagine something pretend. You don't have to put them in a pretend context. You say, in your mind, can you think of a pig? And they tell you what colour it is, and they say, okay, let's make it a green pig. Can you think of that? And the pig is going to rise in the air and drift off. Can you think of it? And this little four-year-old is thinking of these green pigs flying around. You do that, and then test them, and off they go, and they give you correct answers. So we get a very different conclusion from that of Piaget's. Children as young as four are demonstrating this ability to reason deductively, and it's not a late accomplishment. There's something else going on. I'll give you an idea about what that something else might be tomorrow. Here's a third example. It's a very old one. It's a fun one. And again, it's been looked at many, many times. The effects have been replicated, and the original results seem to match precisely those of Piaget. To tell you that Piaget is right, there is a change taking place when children enter the concrete operational stage. Now, this isn't a washing machine. This is a device for getting sweeties. It's actually a gumball machine. So, originally started by Kettlers. There are three panels here which have been lifted up to expose everything that is underneath. At either side is a button that you can push, okay? And if you push it, something will come out of the bottom here. So, first of all, you cover up a central one here, you train the child to see what happens when they push this button. And when they do, a marble comes out of the bottom, okay? And then if they push this one, a full bearing will come out. So, first of all, they learn what happens when you push the button on the left, what happens when you push the button on the right. And you make sure they know, so you say, okay, get me a ball bearing, and they have to push the correct button. Get me a marble, push the correct button. You make sure they've learned exactly how a thing works, what will come out, okay? So then you close these flaps down, you lift this one up in the middle, and you put a marble and ball bearing down in front of them, and you say, see what happens when you put one of these in this hole. So they pick one up, and they put it in the hole, and they discover if it's a marble, then something, they get a candy at the bottom. Okay? If it's the ball bearing, nothing happens. So they learn then how to get the candy by putting in the correct object. Alright? So, as with the reading, as with the syllogism, we've taught them two separate things. They've got separate pieces of information. They know how to get the candy, they know what object to put in there, and they know which button to press to get the object. Now here's the question, can they put these pieces of information together so that when you open up the whole apparatus and say, okay, get yourself a candy, can they do it? Can they engage in appropriate means and reasoning? And of course what we want them to do is think, well, I've got to put a marble in the hole, and I need to get a marble, so I'm going to push this button here and I can get it. Okay, very simple reasoning. Exactly the same as the syllogism. Turns out that when you test five-year-olds, their level of success is very low. Now by success, what we're looking for is a solution that has been thought out ahead of time, okay, and has been worked out by reasoning. I've got to put the marble in the hole, I've got to push the left-hand button, so what the kid does is pushes the right button, gets the marble, puts it in the hole, gets the candy. Okay, that's a direct and correct solution. And only 6% of five-year-olds were producing this. Now, surprisingly, it's extraordinary, but surprisingly, it's been replicated many times. You get a very low success rate with kids. But we were fooling around at halfway to primary school some while back, had exactly the same results. There is a problem for five-year-olds in solving this problem. Now, move on a couple of years, seven, and the success rate shoots up 52%. Now that straddles that transition point Pierre is talking about. Preschool children, pre-operational children, unable to reason logically, can't make this deduction. They get a candy in the end, but they do all sorts of things. They push both buttons, and then they get both objects, and sometimes they put the right one in, sometimes the wrong one first, and then they put the right one in. Eventually, they'll get there by trial and error, but not, apparently, by thinking the solution through, by making a deduction. By 7 years, they're able to think it through. And so that change corresponds very nicely with the change Piaget was talking about. But think about the other studies I've just described, and it doesn't really fit with what happened there. Just by the by, they also tested some adults, and they found a 92% success rate there. So not perfect. Now, no offense to visitors from North America, but these were American college students, so yeah, maybe. Maybe it's all started out. American college students, I'd like it to be exactly the same here as well. Anyhow, that's an interesting contrast. Now, what's going on here? Is it the kids can't reason, and eventually do? Does it map onto what Piaget is saying? Turns out, no, not at all. Later studied by Houston, replicated the original results perfectly. So here we have 4 and 5-year-olds, okay, tested on this head of the box, and you can see a very low success rate. Exactly as they reported, a little bit bigger, but you know, they're not doing very well. We don't get these direct solutions. However, what Houston did was simply modify the equipment in a very simple way. The reasoning was still the same, but the apparatus was easier for the kids to understand. And what Houston thought was, it's an electronic apparatus. Maybe the kids don't understand the mechanism. And that somehow is interfering with their ability to reason effectively and get the produce the correct solution. So what he did was he replaced the buttons with little drawers. So all the kid had to do was to pull out the drawer on the left to get the marble, drawer on the right to get the ball bearing. And pulling a drawer out and thinking about the contents is something that children have been doing since the age of 1 year. So they've got a long history of understanding exactly how drawers work, what the mechanics are. And that transformation changed their success rate. So now we get a very high success rate. We get these direct solutions. When the equipment is understandable, when it's not mysterious and unknowable, when it's something that taps into what the child knows, then they can engage in this reasoning. So these are 4 and 5-year-olds clearly able to solve such a problem. So, you know, we have to be careful how we test children. We have to make sure that we use methods which are familiar to them, that are understandable. As I said last week, it's very easy to demonstrate young children cannot do something. It's much harder to discover what the problem is, whether it's something preventing them from thinking, and to overcome that. And in all of these instances, we can see that Piaget got it wrong, that these younger children do have this ability to reason, to think, but very frequently they're not able to show it because something else interferes with the production of that ability. Let's go back to this study of class inclusion. Remember the beads. Are there more black beads or are there more beads? Remember you were puzzled by that question. It didn't sound right. If you think about it very carefully, you can figure out what you're being asked to do and give the correct answer. But here's another version. This was carried out by Martin Dawson, to Gareth Dawson, working in Edinburgh. And it simplified it a little bit to still get the effect. So we only had 4 items here in the overall category. These are all cows. And some of them are black and some of them are white. And they're deliberately upside down, as you'll see in a moment. So we've got 3 black cows and 1 white cow. Okay? So let's ask Piaget's question. Are there more black cows or more cows? And for the children, these 5-year-olds, only 25% gave the correct answer. So the majority, 3/4 of them, get the wrong answer. They answer black. They say there are more black cows than cows. Okay, let's make one change to the question. One extra word. Are there more black cows or more sleeping cows? These are sleeping cows, they're not dead cows, they're sleeping, okay? Now what happens, it's 100% increase, it's 48% are giving the correct answer. Clearly these children, those that have improved, can make this comparison. They understand that there are more cows in the overall collection than there are in any of the subsets. So they clearly have this knowledge, this understanding here. What's going on? Yes, this question clearly was misleading. Alright? And where it's misleading is in directing the child's attention to the wrong part of the array here. So, are there more black cows or more cows? Black cows, the child focuses on the black cows. Because they're very prominent, there are more of them, they're very easy to see. Or are there more cows? The child is misled into thinking, you must by default be talking about the cow that's remaining, the white one. So they're making the wrong comparison. They've misunderstood the question because the wording is directing their attention in the wrong way. So they're making a comparison between black cows and white cows, and of course they're giving, from their point of view, the correct answer. But from the perspective of the experimenter, it's the wrong answer. They want them to compare the subgroup with the whole group. Okay? Now, by adding this term here, we can direct their attention to the subset and the whole set. Black cows, sleeping cows. And that makes a big difference. And clearly, they can think about these black cows in two ways at the same time. They're both a subset and members of the overall set. And they can come up with the correct answer. So we've got a nice explanation for why Piaget's explanation was wrong. And also a nice explanation for why your reaction to his question was puzzled, because it's a weird question. It's sending you in the wrong direction. So finally, I just want to talk about a couple of studies that have looked at Piaget's claims about the development and understanding of conservation. Remember, he's arguing that young children are figurative thinkers, and they don't understand that number of items or amount of juice remains constant if somehow this perception changed. Now here's one interpretation. Now remember how the experiment is done, okay? So we have two glasses of juice. And we ask the child, initially, at the same level, does this one have more, does this one have more, or are they the same? And the child correctly says, they're the same, okay? Now we pour one into a different shaped container. And what do? We ask exactly the same question. Does this one have more? Does this one have more? Or are they the same? Now, think about it. You're 5, 6 years old, and the teacher asks you a question, and you give an answer. And then, if she asks exactly the same question again, what are the circumstances under which you get asked the same question again? Why do you get asked the same question again? Because you got the first answer wrong. And, you know, you're 5 years old, you've been at school for a year, year and a half, you're beginning to learn what we call the pragmatics of language. How the circumstances under which, you know, people talk and ask you things, and this is something that's high on the list. Kids learn very quickly. You get asked the same question twice, because the first answer was wrong. So what do? They answer the first one correctly, yes, it's the same. Second question, no, it's not. This one has more, and obviously they there are influenced by appearance, but the initial answer may have been the same, may have been correct, but they've changed it because they thought the first one was wrong. They're a bit confused. And all the kids, you know, are resistant to this. They recognize that people very often ask the same question twice after doing something to test your knowledge. Okay? So maybe you have 2 or 3 years experience of being at school, and older children are resistant to the influence of being asked the same question twice because they understand that their knowledge is getting tested. So, Rose and Black did a very simple experiment. You either ask the question twice, or you simply demonstrate, you know, you make the levels the same, you don't ask the question first of all, you ask it after the transformation, and you get very different answers. Children ask the question twice and give incorrect answers. Children ask only once, many more of them will give the correct answer, but the amount is the same. Suggesting that they have this knowledge, they can resist being figurative thinkers, but there's a problem in that they're basing answers on the pragmatic use of language. So that's a very simple explanation for one of the reasons why Piaget may have given the wrong answer. The younger children do have this understanding. And here's a second example. And let me just give a demonstration that comes from Goldstein, Jupiter Garrigal's lab. I can put this on, it's a bit mucky, but imagine you're going to test a child on understanding of numbers. So, you set out one row of counters, very carefully, this is the child's, and then you set out another one, and you make sure that one-to-one correspondence, and you make absolutely certain, oops, no, that's wrong, but put it there. You make sure the length of the rows is the same. You do this very carefully, okay? You ask the child a question, there may be a problem asking the question twice, but there are other factors at play here. So, is this one more? Is this one more? And then the same, is the answer correctly? The same. Now what you do, very deliberately, you start moving this row further apart. Very deliberately. Only that row. You don't touch this one, do this one. Then you come back to the child. Does this have more? Does this have more? Or are they the same? Now what have you done? You've changed the length of the row very deliberately. You've drawn the child's attention because that's all they have to watch. Five-year-olds mistakenly may think the question is not about number, but it's about what you have deliberately done, which is changed the length of the row. And so they say this one has more. Meaning it's got more length, it's longer, not that it has a greater number. In other words, it's not a failure to understand, it's a misunderstanding. Okay? This is Donaldson's point. Now, how did you test this? Well, here's a way. Let's just put it back to where it was, okay? And the child now has answered the first question. They're the same. This doesn't have more, this doesn't have more, they're the same. And then, before you get a chance to do anything else, out comes Naughty Teddy. Oh, look, Naughty Teddy has come out. What's he going to do? Oh, and Teddy swoops down here. Look, Teddy is messing up our nice rows of counters. Oh, bad, Teddy. Go back in your box. No. Okay, now, see what's happened. The end result is exactly the same. Yeah, we end up with a longer row. But the method by which it's been accomplished is completely different. It wasn't deliberate. I didn't do it deliberately. Teddy did it. So it happened by accident. Naughty Teddy has changed the appearance. Okay. So, now I have good reason for asking the question again. Not because the child gave the wrong answer the first time, but because Naughty Teddy has done something and we want to check if everything is okay. Alright? And second, I haven't deliberately drawn the child's attention to making the row longer. Teddy was doing all these things, and the child really was excited watching. Now we can ask the question again. And it turns out that kids do much better after Naughty Teddy made a transformation. Okay? So here we have an experiment about that in the 5-year-olds, only 16% of children with the correct answer. When Naughty Teddy does it, 63%. A massive increase. But clearly these kids understand what's going on, but there are all these other factors that are interfering with their ability to give the correct answer. A lot of it's their attention, a lot of it is the lack of understanding of what happens in these situations. And actually, I'm just going to finish just one slide. This is a lovely little study which, in fact, hasn't been, I think it's been repeated, it should be done again. There is some, not this one, this is just a summary of Donald's point. This is a little study by Chris Pratt. He had a researcher go into a primary school, test kids in the morning on conservation tasks, liquid conservation, pouring juice from one container to another, and so on and so on. The kids were classified as those who gave the correct answers, conservers, and those who gave incorrect answers, non-conservers. Okay? And then in the afternoon, a second researcher, a different person, went back and asked them some questions about what happened in the morning. Miss Henderson was the name of the first researcher. So all of the kids, no matter whether they gave correct answers or not, remembered the important details that Miss Henderson poured juice, and asked questions about how much, and she poured juice from one container to another. But then they were asked questions about why she wanted to know this. Why was she asking questions about the amount when it had been changed, when the juice had been poured from one cup to another? And interestingly, you get strikingly different answers. So the kids who are non-conservers tend to give answers that suggest that she really thought she was doing this to make more juice. She really did think the amount was going to change. Okay? Whereas the older kids, the conservers, all of them realized that she was trying to assess their knowledge, because they were saying things, well, she was asking to see if I knew that the amount was the same. That was the kind of answer that they were giving. The non-conservers could have said the same thing. They could have said, oh, she was asking me questions to see if I knew it would get bigger. But they didn't give any indication that they knew, that they understood the purpose of getting asked these questions. And that, again, could be a clear explanation for why these changes take place. So, young children can think logically. They're not always figurative thinkers. In Donaldson's terms, they are embedded thinkers. They function well in familiar settings. Okay? Pretense, playing with drawers rather than mysterious electronic equipment. Things they understand in a familiar context, they can function very well. That's how you have to test children. Often they misunderstand the experimenter's questions and intentions, and when they do that, they often choose the wrong method or attend to the wrong information. Older children, Donaldson argues, improve, not only because their attention improves, but because they become disembedded thinkers. They don't rely so much on context. For example, they understand that they're being asked these questions because the experimenter doesn't really believe that the amount changes, it's because she wants to know what they understand. Okay, tomorrow, last lecture, last evening, and what I'm going to do is talk in general about Piaget and where he stands today. Okay.